Representative Nelson, would you like to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File 1190. And there's an amendment to it. Did it draft that?
Mr. Nelson, do you want to move the 0192 amendment?
I'd like to move the 0192 amendment. And basically what the amendment does is just change where it says council in the bill to board. And the reason for the amendment is that the bill gives rulemaking authority to this council, and it has to be a board to have that rulemaking authority. So that's why we're changing that.
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, to your bill.
I'd like to introduce Dave Johnson here, and he'll explain the bill. And
Mr. Johnson, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I have a couple handouts here for folks. What this bill does is create a plumbing board in the state of Minnesota that would have authority with respect to the plumbing code and licensing issues in the plumbing profession. The reason that we're here today is because we do not believe that the current system works. As you can see from this handout, there's somebody who can pass this out.
Thank you, Mr. Clemens.
That most states, the vast majority of states, have what you're asking for today. They have 31 states have a plumbing board with rulemaking authority. We're in the minority of states that has a system where the department makes a decision with input from an advisory council. Why we don't think the current system is working is a couple of reasons. First of all, there have been instances where an advisory council has made one decision, and the advisory council is generally made up of experts from the profession, and that's what we're asking for in the board. And those decisions have been overruled. In one particular instance, back when the advisory council and the authority with respect to the plumbing code was in the Department of Health, on seven separate occasions, the advisory council recommended that a particular device did not work, and was overruled seven times, and ultimately the commissioner, after an administrative law judge said that this device shouldn't be included, changed the decision and allowed this device to happen. It was our understanding that this unfortunate situation occurred because the department was threatened with a lawsuit from the manufacturer. We had to go to court to reverse that decision because the device did not comply with the code. There have been other examples as well. And so again, looking at the list, what we're asking for is what pretty much the vast majority of states do. We think that it's important that we have experts and all stakeholders involved in the process. That's why you have a number of contractors, a number of licensed plumbers, and building code safety inspectors on the board representing various points of view. And I think it's important that we find a fair process, and I think this is what this is about, is to find a fair process to address these issues. Because if a vast number of the stakeholders aren't buying into how it works, one of two things is going to happen. Either we can find a system like the plumbing board that is what most other states do, where everybody feels that there's been a fair process and that, you know, sufficient input is taken, or what you're going to find is you being a legislator is going to become the new plumbing board, because we'll just start coming over here and introducing bills on waterless urinals and air admittance valves and all sorts of things because we just don't believe we've had a fair shake, and we have for some time. There are a couple of arguments I'd just like to address that you might hear from others, and one is that somehow this will be more government. And the answer to that is currently there are advisory councils, and all we're asking is those councils be given some authority, so it won't be additional government. and the per diem, or the cost won't increase. The per diem costs that the council members get would be what the board would get. And so there wouldn't really be any meaningful increase to the state in terms of doing this. The second point would be that somehow drives up construction costs. And I guess I would ask you to look at this list, because you can look at a number of states, and I can list some of them, states like South Dakota, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, South Carolina. They are not high construction states, and they all have boards. So I think that, you know, folks who want to argue that somehow construction costs are going to increase, first, we'd like to see that quantified because we don't think it's the case. Second, I think the experience in other states is that hasn't happened. And then to make one last point, I think part of the reason that we got to this point, too, was even though there was an advisory council, that was recently suspended. And so two or three people at the department made the decision they didn't even want advisory council input from the experts anymore. And that, in a lot of ways, was the last straw. Because it was one thing when we had an advisory council that was disregarded. Now these folks don't even get, you know, they used to get to come to the table and not be listened to or have their opinions considered, and now they're not even getting a seat at the table. So, again, we hope that you can support this bill. We think it's a fair process for allowing all folks, input, to have experts have input on the board process. You know, just like in the legal profession, you know, people with legal backgrounds make decisions about certain things. In the medical profession, people with a medical background make decisions about certain things. We're asking that in this particular area that licensed plumbers and contractors have a seat at the table as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions for the testifier? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, the questions I have are on the bottom of page 2, fees and finances. Especially fees collected under sections 326.42 and 47 should be transferred to the council quarterly. Can you tell me what those fees are, how much they are under those two statutes?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Hawes, that is the licensing fees. And it's my understanding that some of those costs right now are actually used to pay the per diem for the advisory council. So we don't see much of an additional increase here. Again, the board members are going to be volunteers. They're only asking for a per diem payment for the days they show up, which is what members of the advisory council are getting right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, good to see you again. Who's got oversight right now, and are they doing a bad job? Are we giving them a chance?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther. There's two answers to that question. Traditionally, with the governor's executive order, which hasn't been codified yet, these boards and some of the authority for these codes, or the councils, were moved from one department to another. And we have experiences, one of which I explained, and others that kind of show that traditionally, in those other departments, that was a problem. I think it's important to note that a lot of the key people came over, so I think we're still dealing, even though we're in a different department now, we're still dealing with the same cast, and we still have the same issues. So I would argue that you know, there's plenty of history to demonstrate that this isn't working, and it's, to answer your question is no.
Any other questions? Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 1190? Seeing none. I'm sorry, sir. I'm a school teacher. I should have seen a hand in the back. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. I'd just like to clarify a couple of things that were stated here earlier. We did suspend the advisory council, the current plumbing code advisory council, at the request of two legislators because they had concern over some of these issues. We did address some of those issues with them, and our next advisory council meeting is scheduled for March. So I'd just like to clarify that was at the request of you, the legislature, that we decided to suspend the current plumbing advisory council. And I'd like to just clarify From the department's perspective, we would prefer the advisory council method. And I understand there's a two-sided faction here, but I think for clarification, you've got on the page, second page, line 2.34, I believe the one site for section 326.47 is the high-pressure piping fees, so I don't think it should be in the plumbing board fees unless there was a mistake on the quote on that one, so just a clarification.
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and members, 326.47 does apply to high pressure and pipe fitters. That's correct.
Ms. Newman, then should the is the only relevant site the 326.42, or is there another site beyond 42 that's also relevant?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to someone who knows more about the difference between plumbers and pipe fitters.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Nelson,
you told that that's a typo. That okay. 4.7 should be 4.5.
4.5. Representative Nelson incorporates that amendment into the bill, changing on page 2, line 34, the reference to 326.47 to 326.45. Thank you for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative House.
I'm not a parliamentary expert, but I think we should vote on that because it's a bill and we can't incorporate it into a bill.
Okay. And folks here are telling me you are a parliamentary expert. Reverend Nelson, would you...
I'll move that on line 2.34, the bill that we changed the 326.47, we changed that to 326.45.
All right. Any discussion getting the high-pressure pipe fitters out of the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Howes. Mr. Chikai.
Chair, no, just members, and our legal staff has just informed me that the way it's worded, it would move all the fees that we collect for licenses and inspections to this board. Was the intent just to cover the cost of the board with the fees?
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
So the intent is that only such revenues as needed to cover the costs of the board are intended to be transferred on a quarterly basis to the board.
Can staff address that in a terminology?
It's happening as we speak, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, this bill also has to go to Commerce, to Finance. We could work on that in the next step, or if she has it.
Patience is not only a virtue, but a necessity. Representative Nelson. Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and members, I would suggest that on page 2, line 33, after fees collected, insert under this provision, and then on line 34, strike under section 3.26.42 and 3.26. Yes, and then strike under section 3.26.42 and 3.26.45. So that fees collected under this provision shall be transferred to the council quarterly.
Mr. Nelson, do you want to move that?
I'll move that suggestion.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Howes.
I might need staff's help. On page 2, line 30, on line 30, I guess, and this relates to the fees that we just fixed. Commissioners shall collect fees necessary for their operation and continuance of the council. It almost appears that if the commissioner wanted, he could choke the council out of business. Might not collect fees designated for that, or is this not a problem? Am I just imagining things?
Representative Nelson, Mr. Johnson, got a comment?
Mr. Chair, again, in Representative Hawes, the intent is that the fees that are going to fund the advisory council go to fund the board. We've tried to set this up so it's as cost neutral as possible for the state. And, you know, I think to the extent, you know, again, this is something we could work on to tighten it up in the finance division. Because it sounds like we probably could do a little tightening up there.
All right. Representative Howe, say,
Mr. Chairman, I'm satisfied with that. Representative Nelson, don't let this out of your sight until you fix it.
you raise a good point, Representative Howe. Any other discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing none. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1190, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Okay. Oh, Representative Nelson. Return.
Drop Nelson Day.
Yes, it is. It is. I had one of those in Housing and Public Health last week. It was Dabney Day. Representative Nelson, would you like to move House File 1283?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1283. And in your packet, there should be a delete all. Actually, there's two delete all amendments, but we're going to use the delete all two amendments.
All right. Representative Nelson, was the H-1283-DE2 amendment? Any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Nelson.
Refer to your packet. There should be a red. Is there red folders?
They may be on the cart still. Look right in front of you.
The red folders. Anyway, what this bill does, and I've been working with the commissioner, Commissioner Brenner, on this. That's why we had to delete all two amendments, and it's been kind of a work in progress going on. But what this is trying to get at is people in the building trades who are working, claim to be independent contractors and they're truly employees, there's some information in the packets that are going around. This has effects on workers' compensation. They're not paying workers' comp on these people because they're not employees, or they claim not to be employees. They're not paying unemployment. They're not paying on Social Security, and they're not taking out income taxes, and it's costing the state government lots of money. There's been a few years back, there was an article in the newspaper that the Department of Revenue estimated that they were losing, not just in construction, but all the way across the board, people that are being misclassified as independent contractors, $700 million a year in taxes not being collected. And so that's what brings this bill forward. I have Kyle Macarius here from the Carpenters who will explain the bill and move forward from there.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Mr. Macarius, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Kyle Macarius. I'm the political director for the Lakes and Plains Regional Council of Carpenters, and I appreciate your consideration this morning of House File 1283. This bill attempts to address a growing and frequent problem in the construction industry, the problem of worker misclassification. Worker misclassification occurs when employers treat workers who would otherwise be waged or salaried employees as self-employed independent contractors. Or as one report commissioned by the U.S. Department of Labor put it, misclassification occurs when workers who should be getting W-2 forms for income tax filing instead receive 1099 miscellaneous income forms. This problem manifests itself, for instance, when a drywall contractor shows up to sheetrock a building with his crew but doesn't have any employees. Instead, all the workers who hang the sheetrock are illegally misclassified as independent contractors, even though they don't meet any of the tests set out by the IRS or the Department of Revenue. By misclassifying employees, contractors don't have to pay for workers' compensation or unemployment insurance. They don't have to withhold taxes or pay Social Security benefits, all costs that their competitors, if they're playing by the rules, have to pay. This is plainly illegal and widely acknowledged as a problem in the construction industry. I do want to make clear that we have no issue with legitimate independent contractors. Our issue here is with people who are cheating the system, lowering standards in the industry, and putting legitimate businesses at a competitive disadvantage. House File 1283 was developed in consultation between our union, employers, and the Department of Labor and Industry. It is a good bill that will make a significant difference towards fixing this problem. Here's how it will work. Independent contractors will register with the Department of Labor and Industry and pay a $150 fee. They will sign a document that certifies, under penalty of a fine, that they meet the tests to be their own legitimate business. Contractors wishing to hire independent contractors will have to verify that the independent has the certificate. Contractors who don't do this or who coerce employees into filing for an independent contractor certificate will be subject to fines. And most importantly, hanging over the heads of both independent contractors and contractors, the Commissioner of Labor will share this information with the Department of Revenue, so the threat of a tax audit hangs over potential cheaters. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for considering House File 1283. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have or to discuss any of this bill in further detail.
Thank you, Mr. Macarius. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Lane.
Is there any minimum limit of income that would be necessary before they have to file for a $150 fee? I can explain it. I'm a part of a small nonprofit, and actually I'm the financial person, so I pay three employees, and then there's several 1099s because we call in somebody from across the country, come and they earn a whole $600. Or there's a local person who does a class and they earn a whole $150 for the class. To have to register as an independent person and pay a $150 fee would be totally honest.
Mr. Macarios.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lane, it's a good question. Two points. One is this bill is only related to the construction industry. It is specifically limited there. And secondly, I believe the, and counsel will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that this would apply to anyone with annual income over $600, which is the same standard used in construction for who needs to receive a 1099. So if you're going to get a 1099 for doing construction work, then you would need to register as an independent contractor to perform such work.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lane, this $100 fee is paid for each job.
Mr. Macarios.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, $150 would be the application fee to the Department of Labor and Industry for being certified as an independent contractor. The certificate would need to be renewed every 2 years.
Okay. Representative Gunther.
Ms. Lane, I remember a couple years ago in conference committee, Senator Bach did attempt to change this. Isn't it already law, or did something happen to that?
Mr. Macarios.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Becker, another good question. 2005 legislative session passed a law that in essence says you shall not misclassify as an employee as an independent contractor. And that's basically where the law ends. We have not seen any significant change in practice in the construction industry due in part, I think, to a lack of an actual mechanism through which to catch cheaters.
That's what the discussion with Commissioner Brenner has been about, as a way to get enforcement. This is allowing them, the Department of Labor and Industry, by using this model to be able to enforce this, because the person will have to come in, certify that they're going to be an independent contractor and that they meet the 9 points that we have in our employment law and our worker compensation law that classify or puts them as an independent contractor, and then he'll be able to go and catch the cheaters, be able to audit them and what kind of work they're doing and follow up on that and give him the mechanism to enforce so that everybody is on a level playing field.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question I had when Senator Bach had a deal, is this going to prohibit my friendly teachers from painting houses in the summertime earning summer money, which has always been a concern of mine in this bill?
Mr. Macarios.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, our understanding is that if anybody can work as an employee to any construction industry at any point, if somebody wanted to have a summer job as an independent business working as a subcontractor to other construction contractors, then they would need to register as an independent contractor to do such work. But I don't believe, and council can correct me if I'm wrong, but this will affect somebody who, say, is going to paint houses for the summer and be paid directly by a homeowner. This would work. This would only apply to people who are subcontracting from a construction contractor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Representative House, then Representative Scalzi. Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, he may have answered my question, but I'm going to ask a question similar. If I was the head cashier at Representative Gunther's grocery stores, and he wanted to remodel a portion of the store and hang some sheetrock, and I was good at sheetrock, and I spent 3 or 4 Saturdays there doing that, and he paid me as an independent contractor and not through my salary, would we then be in conflict with that law?
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Howell, these are tough questions.
tough committee. 8:30 on a Monday morning.
My understanding of the language that is written, Mr. Chairman and Representative Howell, is that if you are operating as an independent contractor performing construction work, then you would need to register as an independent contractor, as your own independent business. You would need to bid that job. I want to make clear, Mr. Chairman, Representative Howell, that this does not change the law in terms of who is an independent contractor and who is a employee. This simply sets up a mechanism through which to catch people who are not abiding by that law. So current IRS and workers' compensation and other rules have tests in place to determine who is an independent contractor and who is an employee. Now, my understanding of that law would be that in order for such this scenario to happen, if you were to act as an independent contractor, you would need to put a bid on that job. You know, you'd have to bid that job. If you're going to hang sheetrock, you would need to bid that job. You need to take the financial risk of such an operation and the potential. You'd have, need to have the potential to profit on that job. It sounds like the scenario to me that you're suggesting you would be acting as an employee, where you would more likely be paid by the hour to do the work, rather than operating as an independent business in the construction industry.
Representative House, Mr. Chairman, this is where we're getting to the what-ifs and the maybes. Before I went to work at Representative Gunther's grocery store, I was a contractor. I hung sheetrock, but I didn't want to do that anymore. My back was getting really bad, so I wanted to work in the grocery store. Representative Gunther knew I was good at sheetrock, and he wanted me to do this. And I told him it cost $1,200 to do it. Now, am I going to have to get a license? Because now Representative Gunther isn't a contractor, he's a grocery store owner. That's where we have to define the difference, because if I would have to get a license, and he would have to, if he would be liable for what he paid me based under this bill, then I start to get nervous.
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, I understand your concern. My understanding of this language as it's written now would not apply to that situation unless Mr. Gunther was a construction contractor. But this bill applies to subcontractors who are subcontracting from construction contractors engaged in the business of construction.
Mr. Chairman, that's my question, and I don't think Representative Gunther and I are going to get into the sheetrock business anymore because of this.
Keep us posted if you do. Representative Scalzi.
So just thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Makarios. I just had a question regarding the kind of the double layer of roofing contractors, where you hire possibly independent contractors who then brings in other people to do roofing. How would this affect that two-step process?
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, this is exactly who we want to affect, amongst other folks. The contractor who a homeowner would sign to do their roof would then employ, and often does employ, independent contractors to actually put the shingles on. So the contractor who the homeowner would contract with and who gives the bid to the contractor, when they hire the people who actually put the shingles on, if they're going to function as independent contractors, which in many cases they do illegally, they would need the actual shinglers, I'll call them roofers, would have to register, if they're going to be independent contractors, with the Department of Labor and Industry. They would need to certify that they meet the legitimate tests to be their own legitimate independent contractors, and the roofing contractor would need to verify that those individuals have the certificate from the Department of Labor and Industry and are certified and meet the tests to be their own independent businesses. However, frankly, Representative, in most cases, these folks are not independent contractors. They are employees who are misclassified as independent contractors.
Any other questions, Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this Sears that sells siding, that hires a contractor, the person who buys the siding doesn't know who the contractor is. This might eliminate some of that. Walmart sells siding. Employee falls off the scaffolding. They sue Walmart. After the siding company, as well as the homeowner. Will this eliminate that?
Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson.
This is what this is getting at. Yes, that would eliminate that because the homeowner currently, in the scenario that Representative Scalzi laid out, the person shows up with their independent contractor. If they fall off a roof, her homeowner's insurance would have to pay for that person's medical bills because they don't have workers' compensation because they're claiming to be independent contractors and they're truly employees. And if you look on page 4, starting at line 4.15 of the bill, it lists what you have to do, and this is identical language to what's in workers' compensation and unemployment. You have to meet all 9 points of the law, and these people really, they're being told when they have to show up, they're being told how much they're going to be paid, they're not bidding the work, they're not incurring any expenses other than showing up on the job site. So truly, they're employees. And they should be covered by workers' compensation being paid for by their employers. And these people are currently working for Walmart show up and they're independent, claim to be independent contractors, and they fall off the scaffolding, they fall off the roof. You as a homeowner are liable for that person getting hurt, and this will actually help save people getting sued.
I have on the list John Nessu wishing to testify. Thank you, Mr. Cario. Good morning, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and take and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Nessie, and I represent a number of construction employer associations here to testify in support of this bill. And as I know the committee has a full schedule this morning, I'll try to keep it brief.
Thank you.
Two of the associations I represent have an especially vested interest in this bill today, and those are the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association, the Minnesota Floor Covering Contractors Association. The reason for their especially vested interest is that the drywall and floor covering industry is notorious for the use of misclassified independent contractors. My contractors compete against those that misclassify independent contractors, and as you heard, there's quite a cost advantage to cheating in that way. The contractors that I represent would support measures that would do anything to help level the playing field among legitimate contractors such as themselves. Concern that they have is that any law that's passed not be unnecessarily burdensome to them in that they're trying to follow the law. Concerns would be additional administrative issues and further liability for legitimate contractors. I think that this bill goes a long ways towards minimizing those concerns, as Mr. Makarios has explained it, and does provide a sound mechanism for the registration of legitimate independent contractors and would effectively discourage, to a certain extent, the use of misclassified independent contractors in the construction industry. I don't think that this bill is a silver bullet, but I do think that it's definitely a big step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Nessie? Representative Nelson, any closing comments?
Just that this bill would go a long way to help, like Mr. Nessie said, level the playing field and get everybody paying what they're supposed to be paying. Currently, I've seen figures where it's anywhere from 20% to 30% advantage that somebody would get by doing this, so it's a big advantage. And when you're in a construction, bidding on a construction job, and you're talking maybe a 1% or 2% profit margin, or 1% or 2% difference between whether you get the job or not, somebody walking in with a 30% advantage really makes it unfair for the legitimate contractors who are out there paying employees, and they're paying the taxes, and they've got workers, they're covering their people with workers' compensation, and they're paying unemployment, which they're required by law to pay. They're basically either have to start cheating like everybody else to stay in business, or seriously go out of business. So this is what this bill is getting after, and I hope you can get all your support.
Right. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1283, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Is Representative Mullery in the room?
He's left, Mr. Chairman.
Is it working?
Oh,
okay. Is Representative Mahoney in the room working through the AMs? Oh, Representative Mulrich. Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Representative Swales, would you like to move House File 754 to be before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move House File 1254, did you say?
754.
754.
Thank you very much. Representative Mulrich, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, and there is a delete all amendment coming out. I'm sorry it wasn't here earlier, but it wasn't here yesterday when I was over, so it appeared this morning sometime before 8 o'clock.
If, Representative Mulrich, then if you can speak to the delete all, describe it for us and speak to it, have you testify to speak to it, we'll move it as soon as we get it in our hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And basically, this is a system that I think it was in the 1930s, when everyone in the state was required to use the licensed plumber, they made an exception for small cities under 5,000 people. And needless to say, things in the state have changed since then. I'm not sure they even had running water in a lot of places at that time. And so right now, I've just talked to the lobbyists for Department of Labor and Industry. They're fine with it. I believe that all of the contractors' associations, the mechanical, I believe ABC and PHCC are all in agreement on it. What it will do will be require a licensed plumber everywhere, including in towns and cities under 5,000, except there's going to be a special restricted master plumber and restricted journeyman plumber classification, which Mr. Crimmins will describe, with people who have worked in it, I believe it's 2 years and meet certain qualifications, they will be able to continue to work in those small towns. And with that, I would ask that you hear from Carl Crimmins from the United Association.
Good morning, Mr. Crimmins. Please introduce yourself to the table and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. And Mr. Chairman, representatives, when we drafted this, talked with Representative Mulrich about this legislation, we wanted to make sure everybody was grandfathered in. We didn't want to have anybody put out of work. So we asked that there be a restricted master plumbing license if you're going to be a contractor. And what that does, they're held to the same requirements as a master plumber. But the main topic we wanted to get to was currently they don't have to be insured. They can work in your house, and they're bonded, but they don't have to have insurance. As a good business practice, we would hope they're insured, but this legislation tells them they have to have the same amount of workers' insurance and hazardous insurance as the existing master plumbers and contractors in the state of Minnesota throughout the whole state. So this would be something for all the consumers. If someone comes to your house and they're licensed, the homeowner should know that they're licensed, they're bonded, and they're insured. So when you're working in your house, you have some recourse. And we have a restricted plumber license. If you have 2 years of experience, you'll be grandfathered in with a restricted plumber's license. If you have 4 years of experience, you'll be grandfathered in as a restricted master plumber's license. So you can still do work in the towns and areas that you do now, currently do. And any questions? I stand for any questions.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lita, all it is now in the form that passed in the Senate.
All right. Representative Swales, would you like to move the AO70250 amendment to be before the committee?
I will move that particular amendment. I don't see the number. Oh, there it is. Thank you. I move A07-0250.
Thank you. And Representative Mulrich, this is the amendment you want to get the bill in the order which you propose.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any questions for Mr. Crimmins? Representative House.
I'm not positive the question would be for him, but on the delete all amendment,
Starting on line, on page 1, lines 13 through 15, we've got new language. No city or town may require a license for persons performing building, sewer, or water service installation, etc., etc. Why are we putting in, that in there? Are we allowing people to do things that aren't trained at all now, or what?
It's not covered.
Representative Mulligan? You guys choose between
us. Mr. Chairman, it's not covered now, but I think he can explain exactly why.
Mr. Kernans.
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, currently in the metro area in towns over 5,000, pipe layers are exempt from a plumbing license from 5 feet outside the building line. We just wanted to make sure that same exemption carried on into the smaller towns. So that's the reason we added that language.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman. So this, well, by your answer, then I'm thinking with Walker, Pine River, towns I represent, we have people that do this now, obviously. Would they then have to have completed a pipe laying training as prescribed by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry? And if that's so, could you tell me what that is?
Mr. Kremins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, I could not. I would have to defer to the Department of Labor and Industry. This language did come from the lobbyist, though, from the pipe laying industry, Michael Robertson. I don't know if he's in the room.
Mr. Rob, would you please come to the table, introduce yourself, and respond to Representative Hunt's questions, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Robertson. I represent the Minnesota Utility Contractors. These are the folks that excavate and lay the pipe from the right-of-way up to the building or the private property. And there was some litigation about, in the late 90s, 1996-97, that concerned whether the people who laid the pipe needed to have a plumber's license. And there was a consent decree that was entered into with the Department of Health that said that determined that they were not required to have a plumber's license, but had to have enough training in the plumbing code to properly lay the pipe in the excavating from the right-of-way to the building. And various organizations, including the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association, have training programs where these folks go through a few hours of training, receive a card, and are therefore trained sufficiently for laying a pipe without a license.
Representative House.
Yeah, just a follow-up. Would this include any piping for septic systems, drain fields, to and from the house?
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, I'm not certain. The department may need to answer that question.
Someone wants to please come forward, introduce yourself to the tape, and respond.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Randy Ellingbow, and I'm with the plumbing program at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. And in regard to your question on the pipe from the house to the septic system, this would affect that particular pipe between the building and the septic system itself. Our jurisdiction under the plumbing code ends at the septic tank, and that's where the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency licensing requirements for septic systems begins.
Okay. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moore, is this another one of those things? Is this solution looking for a problem, or is there a lot of problems out there? I know generally the way people look at it in greater Minnesota and small towns is if you don't do a good job, they're going to roast you at the coffee shop and you aren't going to work anymore. Pretty simple. We have a lot of evidence saying that this is a great problem out here.
Representative,
you have been in small town.
Representative Gunther.
Representative Gunther, North Minneapolis is a small town. I'll do it south.
You just do south.
As you know, Representative Gunther.
Representative Mulligan
knows that because his relatives, his wife's grandparents lived about four blocks from me.
Right.
And he has spent much time there. And as Representative Gunther knows, growing up, I spent summers in a
very small town called Walnut Grove, Minnesota. So, Representative Gunther, it's my understanding that it is a problem nowadays. We want to protect everyone. People, I would think that you'd want to protect the people in your towns under 5,000, I would hope so, but Mr. Kermans can explain.
Mr. Kermans, Mr. Chairman, Representative, 1933, when this exemption was put into force, there was a lot of people in rural greater Minnesota that were on greater Minnesota.
That employed lesser Minnesota somewhere else.
And they were on their own boat and their own section. Today, more and more municipalities are going to water treatment plants as the aquifers are being polluted. Even smaller areas have to go to a municipal water system. In 1933, if you wanted to do some improper plumbing in your house or your neighbor's house, you only damaged your neighbor. Now, with municipal water systems, you could damage the whole township. If somebody's doing something that they're not trained to do and they pollute the water pipe, that pipe goes through hundreds of houses. So our concern is not to wait until something happens, but we thought with the insurance aspect for the consumer, that they would have some comfort of mind when you hire someone to come in your home to do work. And with these municipal water systems growing more and more all the time, that we didn't want to wait for a situation. We thought we would act before there was an accident.
Any other questions for the
Representative House?
Just maybe a follow-up. We're changing, you know, I'm going to pass on this question to Representative Mueller. I'll ask him later.
All right. Thank you, Representative House. Seeing no other questions, Representative Swales removes her motion that House File 754, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Representative Mahoney, we briefly visited high-pressure piping systems earlier this morning on another bill, but we get to come back to it now.
It's always nice to have someone make your argument before you made it.
Something like that. Representative Nelson, would you like to move House File 1336 to be before the committee?
Yes, I would.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm going to guess that either the...
Is there an amendment, Representative Mahoney?
No. The page... that's a different bill.
What is it? Okay.
That's 1208. This is House File 1339, creates the high-pressure piping board, much in the same fashion that the plumbing board was made. It puts a high-pressure piping inspector, licensed mechanical engineer, representative of the piping industry, four high-pressure piping contractors or their representatives, two from metro area, two from rural areas. We wouldn't want to call it greater Minnesota. That would imply lesser Minnesota someplace.
The east side?
Somebody might have said that. Two high-pressure piping journey persons engaged in high-pressure piping systems installation and two representative Minnesota utility companies. Mr. Chair, committee members, high-pressure piping has the ability to be dangerous, and we really need to have people who day-to-day deal with it, making the rules on how we install it and how we maintain it and how we inspect it. And that's what this particular board will do. I'm going to avoid the problem that the plumbing board does with this one and just say that the board will submit its budget to the Department of Labor and Industry.
Representative Mahoney, staff is working. There's a need, as we did on the earlier plumbing board, to change references from council to board if you wish this body to have rulemaking authority.
That would be correct, sir.
All right.
Sorry I missed that.
That's quite all right. Staff is working on that. Representative Mahoney, while I have you, I noticed that on page 1, line 16, the high-pressure piping board, as we'll call it for now, it has 12 members. The plumbing board only had 11.
This has 12, one of the members being either the Commissioner of Labor and Industry or his or her representative.
All right. That rounds us up to 12.
That rounds us to 12. I believe they are a non-voting member if I can read this without putting my glasses, is on.
Yes, you're correct on page 1.18.
Right. All right. Thank you.
Any questions for Representative Nelson, or excuse me, Mahoney?
Well, it's better than Mullery, I guess. For 8 years they've been calling Representative Mullery, and now I'm Nelson. I like that. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, well, we're moving down the alphabet.
The step up.
You get to the, I don't know, OPAS staff.
From the lawyer to the president.
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be everywhere the word council appears in the draft, we would replace that with board.
The chair will move that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any questions on the House File 1336 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Nelson.
I know with my motion to pass as amended.
And be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
We'll be spending more time with you shortly.
I understand that.
Yes. All right. Is Representative Hillstrom available? Very good. Representative Benson, would you like to move House File 571 to be before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will move 571.
Thank you, sir. Representative Hillstrom, welcome. I think this is your first visit here.
I'm sorry?
No? You were trying to visit. It's Monday morning. Oh, who could I forget?
Yeah.
How could I forget? I think by intent. Representative Hillstrom, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 571 is a bill to change the way that purchasing and contracting is done in Minnesota. We don't eliminate the lowest responsible bidder provision, but we attempt to add a best value provision. I served on a city council for many years, and one of my frustrations was when we did some of our contracting, we needed to choose the lowest responsible bidder. And the definition of what responsible was in our case was just whoever was the lowest bidder. And this bill would allow us to have something that we look at instead as the best value. We keep the lowest responsible bidder provision, but we wanted to take into account some other items. We do have the University of Minnesota who has been using this. I believe there's someone here in the event you have questions that you can ask them, but I do have a presenter with me today.
All right. Good morning. We have a significant list of presenters. I just ask that all of them be focused and brief as they can be. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Meg Luger-Nicolai, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Miller O'Brien. We represent the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council, and I've been invited by Representative Hillstrom to speak about this bill. As Representative Hillstrom noted, and as I think is extremely important to keep in mind, this bill does not eliminate low-bid contracting. It does not restrict the use of low-bid contracting, but what it does is create an alternative to low-bid contracting, and it allows the Department of Administration, the Department of Transportation, and political subdivisions of the state to incorporate more information into their contracting decision-making process. The reason that this bill is, I think, crucial is because low bid is really not the same as best value, and you really are not likely to get the same results using low bid, and maybe not less likely, but certainly not necessarily going to get the same results. Now, low bid only considers price, and it really only considers price at the time that a bid is submitted. So that's a computation of man hours and materials costs, and that really gives you a snapshot. Best value, on the other hand, and particularly given the language that Representative Hillstrom has introduced, allows you to look at past performance. It requires that you look at price. It requires that you look at the contractor's future plans for the project being bid, and thus gives you a much greater picture of what's actually going to happen when this project gets underway. The proposed best value definition, as currently drafted, says we are going to look at what other agencies and other people who work with you say about your performance as a contractor. Have you stuck to a timetable? Have you been able to stick to a budget? Have you had any significant change orders, you know, other issues that really indicate a lack of planning in the process? And this bill allows the agency to look at that information. And I think this bill is important because study after study has shown that best value procurement process is really bring a great best value. They bring great value to the departments that use them. And the federal government has used best value for a number of years. They found it reduces punch lists, it reduces change orders, it reduces delay. And in the case of the University of Minnesota, they've demonstrated that they've been able to save over the estimated bid price. So this bill will result in short-term savings to the state and long-term value in the construction that the state buys. And the language that Representative Hillstrom has proposed permits agencies to engage in an open, fair, and objective process of assessing a contractor's ability to perform. And I think it allows a greater deal of information than the low-bid system currently permits. But it's an alternative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing that I did want to add is we have currently had one stakeholders meeting in which there were a large number of people in the room. I guess I didn't count. And we do have another stakeholders meeting scheduled for next week. And so I think what you'll hear is the Department of Transportation, DOT, would like they currently have a system, and they don't want this to override the current system that they use, but they want it as an additional. So we're open to working on that, and others want the language to be less subjective or to make it clear. And I'm happy to work on all of the issues. And so just so you know, we do continue to work with stakeholders on this issue, but we don't have an amendment for today.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Ms. Lugar-Nicolai.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that there's a stakeholders meeting this Wednesday as well. So.
All right.
Conversations are ongoing.
Questions for the witness? Thank you. Next, I see Mr. Harry Melander on the list. Mr. Melander, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed with your comments.
Good morning. My name is Harry Melander. I'm the Executive Secretary of the St. Paul Building and Construction Trades Council. We in the building trades appreciate the great work that the Representative Hillstrom has done and appreciate the opportunity, Chairperson, of me to schedule House File 571 this morning. Best value contracting is a tested, proven method for construction contracting. It's an alternate to the low bid system. It requires projects to be awarded to contractors that offer the best combination of price, high quality, performance, instead of just low bid. Under House File 571, state and local governments would still have the option to either use the low bid system, which is currently in place, or to have flexibility with the best value system. Best value contracting rewards contractors who have skilled, trained employees and have demonstrated the ability to finish jobs on time and on budget. This is really an issue about good government. Best value contracting is good for the state, good for local governments, and it saves taxpayers money and provides flexibility to agencies. Best value contracting is proven and tested. The federal government uses best value contracting, as do a number of state governments. Best value contracting has already shown great results in the state of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has a pilot project that has used best value contracting for mechanical, electrical, and roofing contractors, and we'll have an individual representing the university today that will testify in regards to their experience so far. Best value contracting is good for taxpayers because best value methods save money. In fact, the university will also state some of the savings that they have found in their pilot program so far. Best value contracting is good for women and men in Minnesota because it creates an environment that rewards skills and encourages training. We in the building trades are proud to have highly skilled and trained workers as our members and appreciate the fact that best value contracting, unlike the low bid process, takes that training and skills into account. In conclusion, our organization supports the passage of House File 571 because we believe that the best value method provides a better product for state government while saving taxpayers money and rewarding highly skilled individuals, contractors, and workers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Miranda. Any questions for the witness? Seeing none, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Melander.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Happy to be here today to lend our comments of support for Representative Hillstrom's bill. City authority on this issue already has some legal clarification. In the case of Westford Construction Inc. versus the City of Minnetonka, the city chose to go with a best value construction bidding process where in advance they put together a list of criteria they would be using, assigned a point value to each of those criteria, and used that to qualify candidates for the contract. The appellate court in Minnesota did uphold that use of that tool for the City of Minnetonka in that case because all of the information was specifically laid out to all potential contractors in advance of the contract being let. So what we really see this bill as is a clarification of that statutorily. We think that that would provide some significant benefit to have statutes actually reflect that authority openly instead of using only the precedent from a couple of court cases for that purpose. We are working with Representative Hillstrom and the other stakeholders to try and add some specificity to it so we don't end up with cities that think they understand how to use the tool and maybe have a mistake that causes them some significant pain and suffering later. At least our insurance trust folks would like it if we did that. But cities do have some experience with this and, in fact, are hopeful that as we work through discussions on this as a construction contracting tool, that we look at some of the other types of procurement that could benefit from this. Cities, for instance, would like to use this with technology and electronic purchases and the services connected to them, as obviously the lowest responsible bidder sometimes is not what you want when you're putting a new computer system in and contracting for the services to support it for your community. You may want other criteria with experience with those type of systems, long-term training for the employees that are going to be running at those kinds of issues. Could be very important for communities. So we're hopeful to use this as a continued tool for cities and that this bill will help ensure we fine-tune that tool. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you, sir. Mr. Joe Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'll keep my testimony brief. I think Mr. Johnson made many of the points that the counties would agree with. We think this would be a great policy. We're not ready to jump headlong into it, but it's permissive, and we think it'd be great to keep working with the stakeholders that Representative Hillstrom's pulled together to find a way to put this into place. We do think this is the right direction to go, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Matthews? Thank you, sir. Mr. Brayfogle? I hope I got that right, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please pronounce your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
That was pretty good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Bill Brayfogle. I'm the Director of Design and Construction for Minnesota State Communities and Technical Colleges System. We see the bill as another tool in our kit bag that we could possibly use. It is an option, and we would look at being able to support that somewhere down the road if this bill were to pass all the way through.
Questions for Mr. Bakehogle? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate the brevity. Mr. Grussing. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Justin Gressing. I'm the Director of Project Delivery with Capital Planning and Project Management at the University of Minnesota. And you got the pronunciation correct, which most people don't do. So
oh, wow.
Very much, Jim. Just briefly want to assert that the University of Minnesota does not take a position on this particular legislation, but we do employ a best value process in our construction procurement. We've done a pilot project whereby we've procured and have in the pipeline 27 projects. A total of $7.5 million is budgeted for those projects under this program. What we have let so far is about $6.5 million in work, so we've saved about 13% using this process. 9 out of the 17 projects that have been completed came in where the best value contractor was also the lowest price contractor, but we feel that we got better service and better thought about our project using this process. So for us, it's been very successful. It's also allowed us to track and record change order rates on our best value projects that have been completed so far. We have less than 1% of contractor generated change orders, which is industry standard is generally much higher than that when you're working in a low bid environment. Unfortunately, the university generates its own change orders, and that's a little bit higher, but we're trying to get that under control as well. So that's what I have to say. Appreciate the time to be here.
Questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 571? Please come up to the table, identify yourself for the tape, and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dean Thompson. I'm the co-chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Section of Construction Law, and I believe the committee has been handed out some procurement principles that the section has developed over the years, because the section has a long-standing interest in best value procurement in the state at all levels. The section recognizes best value as having many advantages, but it also recognizes that there are many problems inherent in the process. There can be more favoritism in this process, more undue influence, and a possibility of decisions based on arbitrary and unfounded distinctions. So what the section has always tried to do is balance the benefits with the potential problems with this type of procurement. And the question is how to do that. And we've worked with many of the industry stakeholders, public agencies such as MnDOT, DOA. You've heard from Minsky and the U of M. We've worked with those entities. And in fact, we did develop some very specific and good legislation, the section believes, to allow best value procurement in areas such as design build, construction management at risk, purchase order contracting. But that process took a while. The legislation that was developed is pages long, and rightfully so, to provide needed guidelines, to put parameters under what would otherwise be unbridled discretion in determining what's best value. And the success and the public confidence, I think, in those processes for the U of M and Minsky results from the careful legislation that was produced. And I'm here to say on behalf of the bar section, we'd like to work with Representative Hillstrom and the other stakeholders to ensure that the public is protected by this. Because without transparency, without maintaining the integrity of the process and the accountability, people will have doubts about the best value process. And I know that from my personal experience in litigation over these various issues when it's not done properly. I'd like to just point out before concluding three of the first top bullet points of the section's procurement principles, namely that the award criteria must be clearly identified, quantified, and weighted in the solicitation, and the award must be made to the, according to that stated criteria. And why that's so important is it's essential that the requested supply be announced at the solicitation so people know how to meet it with the demand, because otherwise after the fact, justifications are used for making a selection, which undermines everybody's confidence in the selection process. And that is directly tied to the second bullet point in avoiding opportunities for favoritism and undue influence. And it's important also that thought be given how to maximize competition in this process. So we do stand ready to cooperate. It's mentioned that this type of procurement system is just another tool in the toolbox. And that may be true, but some tools are dangerous to use. You have to have anti-kickback equipment, and you should wear safety goggles and a hard hat when you're using it. And that's no different than this type of procurement method. It has many advantages, but has drawbacks. So thank you for allowing me to give these comments, and I look forward to working with the representative.
Questions for Mr. Thompson? Thank you for joining us today, sir. There's another gentleman in the room who wishes to testify as well. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm John Fletz, head of member services with the Minnesota Electrical Association. And the majority of our members are electrical contractors. We represent about 450 electrical contractors. A number of them are small, medium-sized shops from outstate Minnesota. We do have a few concerns with the bill, and mainly we feel that, and this has been touched on already, that there are a number of subjective tests to determine whether a contractor would get a bid. And if contractors, especially small and medium-sized shops, haven't done as much work with the state, that they might be a tendency to freeze them out from obtaining bids. And the concern is also that there are a number of subjective tests, and who would determine what bids would, who would get which bids. And this could actually increase delays and raise litigation costs, especially if somebody did not get a bid and all of a sudden they're challenging, well, why didn't I get a bid? What tests were used to determine who was the best value bidder? And then we also feel, and this comes from the fact that a number of our contractors are outstate bidders. There's nothing to take into account whether a person would get a bid because they know and are familiar with their local area. They're familiar with the area that a project is being constructed, and you're not looking at and taking into account that in terms of determining the best value. And those are the main concerns that we have today. We feel that the process would actually freeze out small and medium-sized contractors in outstate rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment that that is not the intent of this legislation, and we are working with, again, the University of Minnesota as part of their and how they've experienced it. And we want to make certain that we have a fair, we have an open process. We don't want it to create lawsuits, and so that's the reason for the continued meetings of the stakeholders.
Questions for Mr. Pletz. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pletz, what in the process that currently is with STOP, and you're saying that knowing the process, knowing the local official, knowing the way they work, giving current people that are in those areas an advantage. I'm thinking of a big nationwide company, and I deal with contractor and construction myself in my real other job outside the legislature. But talking to one contractor for one doing a job for a big nationwide company, he said, well, they get a leg up because they've done a few of them. They know their process. They know their billing. Other contractors come in and when they bid these jobs don't know that and end up having problems along the way because, well, they don't know the process. They don't know the idiosyncrasies of this individual contractor or this individual company. And they said that gives them an advantage because they've done work for them before. How is that any different than what you're saying, that knowing the intricacies of different localities, how they would be give somebody advantage by under the best value practice?
Mr. Potts.
Thank you for the question. Again, our concern is there currently are requirements in order to become approved contractor, and those are minimum requirements, and we feel the system works as it currently is set up. All of a sudden, you're throwing in additional subjective tests, and I think our main concern is nobody really knows, although there are a number of tests that are listed in the proposed bill, nobody would know how those are used, and whether are you going to weigh the different eight or nine different tests that you're looking at. There's no way to determine how that they would be used. And again, that's our concern. But there's a minimum requirement for approval right now. It works. There's no need to expand it.
Any other questions for Mr. Pletz? Thank you, sir. Any other question? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 571? Any last comments from Representative Hellstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, this is an important issue. I hope that you'll give us great consideration and move us on to the next committee so we can have a hearing tomorrow.
All right. Representative Benson.
I move the House 571 to be passed being referred to Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Mahoney.
Yep. Oh, thank you very much. That's right.
Yeah.
This is quite a little. Okay.
timber industry.
Yes, Representative Mahoney is supporting the pulp and paper industry here this morning. Members, for your information, the committee does not have the bill properly in its possession. So we will be just doing an informational hearing regarding the delete all amendment. And it's, I recognize that it's only, what, 15 of the 20 sections, Representative Mahoney, that we're looking at?
Give or take one or two.
Well, we're just trying to be efficient here. And I'm trying to see if we can specify better for committee members which of those.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, if you could, Mr. Representative Mahoney.
The first, what is it, two. The first three articles, other than transferring some powers from one department, such as the Department of Public Safety, to the Department of Labor and Industry, there's really nothing in the first three. It starts on Article 4.
So it's on Article 4. All right. Let me do this, particularly since this is an informational hearing. Can I get a show of hands? How many people in the room want to testify either for or against the bill?
Really?
Cool. Mr. Governor Mahoney.
I do my homework, sir.
That you seem to, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if I might just start with some of the highlights of the bill and really what it does. I've had numerous questions about what piece of the code can I put in here or what piece of the code is being changed in there. This bill does not change the code at all. There's apparently an amendment on escalators coming, but that would be the only change to the code itself. This bill does not change the number of 2x4s in a wall, the thickness of pipe being carried, or anything of that nature. It does change the way we adopt, amend, interpret, and enforce the code. Big difference, and it's something that's been a contentious issue for the last few years. This bill transfers, it really codifies Executive Order 192 or 196, which transferred all the various code enforcement agencies over to the Department of Labor and Industry. It does a substantial number of changing definitions and clarifying definitions. It has an awful lot of technical language, language updates, updates references. It moves fees collected from the state treasury to the construction code fund, which will pay for code enforcement. It removes or ends a couple of licenses in electrical and plumbing, three. It deals substantially with reciprocity and changes that dramatically in the state. Reduces fees in boilers and contracting licenses, increases fees in other areas where needed to cover the cost of enforcing and inspecting and enforcing the code. It creates boards versus councils and outlines rules and rulemaking authority and the members. And then as I stepped out of the room when Representative Mullery was presenting his bill, but this bill also has a part in it that removes the plumbing, requires a plumbing license for towns under 5,000. Grandfathers in all people that are doing it at this particular time, but no longer will you be able to live in a small town and not get the quality of work that we get in larger cities. Having said that, I will start with Article 4. This is a large bill. I've read it 5 or 6 different times. I'm just going to go down the bill summary, starting on page 4, at Article 4. The first, everything on that page, sections 1 through 7 in Article 4, is either language updates or technical changes. 8 and 9 are also technical changes. Section 10 allows for an electronic version of the code to be transferred to or to be sent to municipalities, hopefully saving them some money. Section 11 in Article 4 clarifies the building officials, the commissioner's ability to deal with building officials. setting educational standards and setting standards for their certification. 12 is deals with surcharges, 13, 16 are language updates, 17 is technical changes, 18 defines elevator inspection, and 19 defines an elevator inspector. Not a whole lot of change to those, either one of those two. 20 lays out the requirements when you repair, alter, or service an elevator and what you have to report to the Department of Labor and Industry. 21 and 22 are technical changes. Article 4, Section 23 deals with penalties, which is not under the purview of this committee. It just changes it from a $1,000 fine to a $10,000 fine. I will skip down to Article 4, Section 26, which is the membership and duties of the Construction Code Advisory Council, but it's been changed to board. And I believe that is in this amendment to 1205. It removes the Department of Health, Department of Commerce, Department of Administration, and Public Safety, and adds in the Department of Labor and Industry. You can read it as well as I can. It lays out who is on the board. Someone from the Board of Electricity, High Pressure Piping, Boiler Industry, Manufactured Housing, Public Utilities, Minnesota Building and Construction Trades, Local Units of Government, and it eliminates the sunset, if I remember right in here, yep, and outlines rulemaking authority and requires them to meet at least twice a year. 27 through 33 are technical changes in definitions. 34 updates references to federal law. 35 and 36 is again how they transfer funds from the state treasury to the construction code fund, which is going to pay for all of this. I will skip down to section 50, where it says license required. It extends licensing requirements to every facility, and this is under manufactured homes, deals with manufactured homes. Every facility manufacturing manufactured homes in Minnesota or for shipment into Minnesota. And that apparently is the new language if you build a home, a manufactured home in Iowa or Wisconsin or Timbuktu, you have to have a license now to sell it and move it into Minnesota. It adds requirements for the manufactured home to carry dealers to carry liability insurance. Section 51 increases the bond and the liability insurance, the amount of liability insurance to $1 million for the liability insurance and the bond requirement. I'm drawing a blank on the dollar figure, but I do know that it increased it. Section 52 requires you to report your liability insurance underwriter to the department, much in the same way we do when we get a driver's license tab. We have to say who is our auto insurance. Section 54 talks about the background information you need to get a limited dealer's license on a manufactured home part. And in here, much of this is 54 through 58. It deals with licensing for manufactured homes and dealers. And the one question that's come up, and another representative had a very big concern. He was worried that in that particular part, it talks about the requirement that if you have a criminal history, and he was worried because we've done a lot of work on training young men and women in our state institutions for careers in building construction, and he was concerned about that. It really deals with someone who has a criminal history of fraud and misrepresentation, and that is what we're trying to avoid. If you're selling something to someone in a mobile home manufactured home park, you should have a very clean record and not have any hint of fraud or misrepresentation when you're selling to people, a home to someone. I'm going to skip down to Article 5, which deals with the electrical.
Yes, and let me just one thing. The change from council to board is not in this version of the amendment at this point. So it's just something to keep our eyes for. As Newman says, it's
I believe,
an attraction.
I believe in the bill there is instructions to the revisor, and I'm hoping that that covers it, but I am not positive because I met with the revisor on Friday afternoon and left at about late in the afternoon. And that was one of the things we were talking about trying to do.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Article 5,
Representative Mahoney. Representative House. Mr. Chairman, what would be your desire as Representative Mahoney explains this 800-page bill as to when we should be allowed to ask a question, because I have Section 5 marked up pretty well. Should we just go through and let him...
Why don't we... Thank you for asking, Representative House. Why don't we let Representative Mahoney present Article 5 and then you respond.
How long does the chairman plan to go this morning?
Not as long as we may need to.
Just be a school teacher, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or a politician.
Either one doesn't answer it the way you want her.
Representative Mahoney, what do you think on Article 5?
Well, if there's going to be questions, I will go right to that particular part of the bill, just in case. It will be helpful if you have questions about it that you tell me the page and line number, because this gets a little, it's a big bill, as you said. Sections 22 are clarifying language and technical changes. Section 3 defines an elevator constructor. Section 4 is an elevator contractor. Section 5 defines who a lineman is. That would be the person who works on the overhead power line. Section 6 defines maintenance electrician. That would be someone who works, say, at an easy example would this have been the Ford plant. There is certainly a contractor that comes in and does electrical work, but Ford also would have had its own electrical personnel. Section 7 is the master elevator constructor. Section 8 clarifies the language for a contractor. Section, I'm going to skip down to 14, electrical work defined, and it adds technology circuits or systems to the definition of electrical work, which apparently was a big issue for the electricians. I didn't quite understand it. Section 15 goes to supervision requirements clarified. It provides greater specificity concerning requirements for supervision of an unlicensed individual doing electrical work and substitutes individual for person. What we're trying to get away from is, as a German pipe fitter, elsewhere in the bill, I'm required to supervise an apprentice. If an unlicensed person is working on the job site, they have to have direct supervision. Well, what we found is we've been having electronic supervision. Now, I see a lot of you have glasses on, and many of you have the same joy of a set of reading glasses. What people have been doing is say, the journeyman would call up the attorneys and say, take out your cell phones, show me a picture of what you're doing. I don't know if you've looked at your telephone lately, but if you want to try and make sure that they've got the right kind of wiring in there, or the right size pipe, or the right schedule of pipe off of a picture on the telephone, it'd be a little difficult. So what we're doing is we're actually defining that they have to be in the physical presence. 16 is clarifying language. You get down to 19, which creates the electrical board consisting of 11 members appointed by the commissioner. They must be two electrical suppliers from rural areas, two master electricians, two journeyman electricians, one registered consultant electrical engineer, two power limited technicians. The board does not expire. The board must form a complaint committee, a technical committee, and a program committee. It covers the composition and responsibilities of these committees. And specifies the power of the board and requires the board to meet at least 4 times a year. I do want to inform the committee, last night as I was going over the bill, I got an email and called. The state has 92 contract electrical inspectors, and there were some concerns with the minimum inspection charge, which at one time was 20 and then was moved to 35 and then had some provisional, some take the total permit and divide by 35, and that's the number of inspections you can have prior to being charged. And what was happening is the rule inspector says that they can't do an inspection for $30, $35, because many times they have to drive 40 or 50 minutes one way. So they were very concerned. They were less unhappy. Actually, it sounded like they were reasonably happy on the $30 for a minimum charge and take out all the rest of the language that dealt with that, which this bill does. And they had a concern about being on the electrical board. Well, one of the other provisions in here is the board removed the ability for the board to set compensation and hire electrical inspectors. So now there is the ability to put an electrical inspector on the electrical board, and we'll try to do that. That basically covers Article 5.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, I could be wrong here, but in the explanation of your summary, okay, you have Subdivision 4, eliminate special electrician license.
Correct.
I'm not finding Subdivision 4 in the bill. It goes from Subdivision 3D to Subdivision 5.
Oh,
it is. Now I just found it.
Yep.
Okay.
And which page is that?
It's on page 58. I just found it, so now it'll take me a minute to read what you're getting rid of. I guess my first question, Mr. Chairman, if we were allowed, would be allowed to ask a couple of questions.
Certainly, Representative House.
I haven't had enough time to read Subdivision 4, but especially electrician. Is this got anything to do with low voltage?
Representative Mahoney.
Every concern about low voltage has been worked out in this particular bill. We had concerns with the technology circuits. We had concerns with a line in here that referenced the National Electrical Code Subdivision 411, and come to find out that it really deals with pipe organs. it does not. There was a discussion about removing the sunset or extending the sunset on low voltage. That wasn't changed. One of the things is I have read the bill. It deals with, it changes a particular class of license for an electrician from towns and cities of 2,000 to 2,500. I was more inclined to remove that for the same reasons that we removed the plumber's restricted license for cities under 5,000. I was not successful at that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, in page 52, section 14, line 33, you've added technology circuits or systems as electrical work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is everything to do with technology circuits and systems, is that actually high voltage?
Representative Mahoney.
No, it is not. My understanding with that is that there was no clear definition that an electrician was able to do those particular types of boards. Now, that would be like that thermostat that's behind you is a technology circuit. And it all goes all the way up to the circuitry boards at a power plant. we just put it into law that they are able to do that because it was put in for masters. And I know, I didn't quite get it either, but I thought if you had an electrician's license, you could do anything that had electricity going through it and wires. But apparently, they wanted some clarification. And I was very clear with the low voltage that this does not, this technology circuits does not affect electronic door locks, fire alarms, garage door openers, small boilers, small mid-sized boilers.
Mr. Chairman, maybe to make it easier, not today, but staff could check on the definition of technology circuits or systems, and then my question would be, and I can't think of who does it right now, but I use an example. Best Buy sells you some kind of fancy integrated system for your home, and they have people that come out and install this. Now, first of all, I'd like to know if Representative Mahoney's bill allows an electrician to do it, and I can't believe they wouldn't be allowed to do it under current law, but would this eliminate some person that is now installing this kind of stuff and is not working directly with electrical high-power wiring?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, this bill is in here, and again, it's on the page bill, it's a little hard to find. Does allow for those type of systems. It's specifically cable installers, phone installers, speaker wires, computer networks in a home. Yeah, that is in here somewhere. And if for some reason it has been left out, I will check it again. I will find it. And when it comes in front of the committee tomorrow, not only will I find you the thought, show you where it's going in, but it will be put in. Make sure it is. But I know it has been in and should still be in.
All right. Well, Representative Mahoney, proceed.
The highlights.
Article 6. We get to Article 4. This clarifies and sets up language for municipalities and the commissioner to complain review and lays out the rules and regulations for it. Article 8 is the apprenticeship, or is apprentices and requires apprentices to be supervised by a journeyman. Reciprocity is Article 9, and reciprocity comes up throughout the bill. What we have done, Minnesota has a very high standard for its licensed trades. We are trying, and we have a lot of work in many instances. What we're trying to do is require everyone coming from out of state to be held to our same standards. We've given them 24 months for a temporary license, but in 5 years, if they were 24 months in the state within 5 years in order to continue working, they must take our test, whether it's a high pressure steam or electricians or plumber's license or any other license, boiler's license. That covers everybody, and most of the tests are not the three or four main crafts are relatively difficult. Actually, they're very difficult. They're less difficult when you get to contractors and mobile homes, manufactured homes, and some of the other things that it deals with. Water conditioning is being another. I'm going to skip to Article 8, Subdivision 4, to get a definition of owner for the purpose of residential contractor and remodeling, and is changed to the person who has a legal or equitable interest in the real property. Section 5 defines roofer for the purpose of residential roofing. Section 6 removes exterior plaster and stucco is removed from the list of general installation specialties. I have not been able to find a good reason for that. It would be a guess. There is the department here. It is part of language. They can certainly explain it if someone wants a deeper explanation of that. I will keep that out just in case. Again, Section 8 is information required on the reciprocity. 9 is manufactured home installers excluded from regulations. What that does is if someone coming in from out of state with their manufactured homes, and they come to the commission and say, I really don't want to take the test, the commissioner can waive that. I don't know that that test is difficult enough to require anyone wavering that. Section 11 allows for electronic testing of contractors and reduces the license fee from $100 to $70. Section 18 updates statutory reference. What this does is it requires a municipality. I'll use myself as an example. Many of you have heard or listened to me say many things about my remodeling. I'm a general contractor. I had to pull all the permits. I am unlicensed as a general contractor. The city of St. Paul would be required to notify the Department of Labor and Industry that an unlicensed person has taken out a permit. Kind of to make sure that we're tracking some of this stuff. Section 20 is the bonds and insurance, and that really increases that for these contractors. Increases the bond to $15,000 for residential roofers, and increases liability insurance for residential contractors from $100,000 to $300,000. Advertising under Section 21 requires that they put their license number on the website or internet ads. Again, reciprocity is in 25. Section 26 is a written contract that must be given. Apparently, some lobbyists want to talk to me about that. Section 27 is denial of a license. And that is where I was speaking a little earlier about the, comes underneath the same part. If you have a prior criminal conviction, it only applies if it's fraud or misrepresentation. Contract recovery fund under Section 29. This is something that's been worked on by many, many people. Recodifies clarifies the contract recovery fund and increases the claim limits from $15,000 to $50,000 and increases the contractor's fees. Boiler, pressure vessel, and boats. I will say nothing other than they're reducing the fees, and the department has done a stellar job in there because we had, Representative Gunther remembers, we had a huge backlog of undocumented boilers, which, if they blow up, make a really big boom. We have a very small backlog now, and the department says that they can do it without those fee increases that we did to keep a couple extra inspectors. High pressure piping. Everything that was in my bill earlier is in this bill, including the reciprocity, which is, again, is 24 months of a license and take the test in 5 years. You get into the apprenticeship. I'm going to go to Article 12. Section 1 is the apprenticeship board. We're putting that into law. Changes the apprenticeship advisory council to apprenticeship board. Gives oversight and consultation with the director of labor standards. And this is to perform the duties at that office with the oversight and consultation of the apprenticeship board. And that is really the important language in their consultation, because there was no requirement that the board, any of these boards, be consulted. And now we are putting that into law, and all these councils being changed to board. The electrical board in Article 13, again, went over earlier. Plumbing board has been gone over. And this is where the cities and towns under 5,000 is dealt with that license. The license, we're grandfathering in everyone who's doing it now, but we, after December, January 1st of 08, we will not issue any more license, limited or restricted plumber's license. Article 16 is the Fire Protection Council. Article 17 is the High Pressure Piping Board. Article 18 is the Building and Construction Code, and this is really the new board that is being developed. It has 11 members. Dealing with all the stakeholders in construction, and we'll have consultation with the commissioner on any on issues. You get into, and that is where carpenters and general contractors are brought in. The Mechanical Systems Board, members, that will have a lot of work to be done
but it's starting to deal with HVAC systems, gas codes, and some other things. These systems are becoming more and more vital as we go. The university, we built a system over there to deal with soybean rust. And how we contain all that is done through the HVAC system. We're coming into a technology economy and clean rooms, and clean rooms need air changes and air filtration systems. Everything from where you just need a hairnet to you have to walk in with makeup air. So there's a lot in this particular bill. I can answer as many questions as you have time.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Any questions? Representative Swales.
Representative Mahoney, when we looked at this before, and you raised this question when you were going through this today, we were talking about the section, Article 8, Section 6, where we're talking about the special skills required in the trades. And you questioned before and you questioned today the exterior plaster and stucco being removed from the general installation specialties. When we looked at the bill before, I thought that I had seen that it was moved to the special skills, which can be found on page 97, and I'm not seeing it today. So I do we have a different copy, a different version of the bill than what we saw before?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair. Yes, you do. This is another Toledo amendment trying to deal with, there was a lot of repetition in that particular one.
Okay.
I'm going to call up the department and ask them about that, because I, to be honest, I
well, it was here before, because I was puzzled by that, as you know, being from Woodbury, we're very concerned about the stucco issues out there, and I was delighted to see that it had been moved to special skill, and now I'm not seeing it in the special skill. So if you can make a notation of that, and see if that could be added in before it goes to the next round.
I can certainly understand why Representative Swales is asking about this area.
Representative Swales is not the only person asking about stucco and mold.
I would believe that. Is there someone in the room? Sir, please, come forward.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Would that be on page 98? It mentions exterior finishing and it's got exterior plaster and stucco.
Yeah, I think that's where it was moved to.
Sir, please introduce yourself to the tape and respond.
My name is Charlie Durenberger. I'm the Enforcement Services Manager at the Department of Labor and Industry Construction Codes and Licensing Division. Very simple explanation for what we're trying to do here. Especially contractors have always been exempted from the state licensing requirements, and the definitions of eight special skills are in 326.83. What we discovered is there's a redundancy. Exterior plaster and stucco appear under both the definition of exterior finishing and general installation specialties. So we're removing it from general installation specialties and leaving it in exterior finishing.
Ms. Wells, does that satisfy your curiosity?
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Other questions for Representative Mahoney? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, I know you've been working very hard on this, and I assume that, and you're taking a lot of people's suggestions, I assume you're going to continue to do that when people have questions. Is this going to go right to the floor? Is it going to go to Commerce and then to the floor?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
The planned path for this, and that's one of the reasons for the informational hearing, is to get to Commerce and then be moved over to government operations policy, and then be moved to the finance committee, and then go to state government finance, and finally into higher ed and workforce development, because that's where the department's budget is. So it's got three more, at least four more stops.
Representative Gunter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, whether I vote for this or not will be dependent on if this will take it out of the governor's bill that I carry. And I love it.
I think it does.
Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I think it does.
Any other questions to Representative Mahoney? Members, I'd remind you that this was just a courtesy hearing. We do not have the bill in our possession, but thank Representative Mahoney for coming and presenting on these.
And members, I would have, if there had been any suggestions, the chair and I have both agreed that they would have been made in the next week tomorrow. But I do want, this is a bill in progress, and if members have concerns or questions or suggestions, I'm open to them all.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Members, the last piece of business before us is to approve the minutes of the March 9th meeting.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We stand adjourned.